This is an ABC podcast.
Good morning. This is Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. Today on the show, we take a closer look at the outcome of the United States' historic meeting with Pacific leaders and what it means for the future of the region. And the Queen's face is on many of our coins and notes around the region. So what happens now that she's dead? Well, plans are underway to get her son in our pockets.
It is a normal process now that we'll have to change from the Queen's effigy to the King.
And the Guam kingfisher might one day fly free on the islands again after snakes forced the bird into captivity.
The brown tree snake, when it arrived, had a big party and a big snack festival. And all the birds, unfortunately, faced their demise.
We'll hear about efforts to revive the birds' populations, all that and more today on the show. I'm Priyanka Srinivasan. So glad to have your company. First, though, despite its early refusal, Solomon Islands was among the 14 Pacific countries to endorse a new joint partnership with the United States. The new arrangement aims to counter China's influence in the Pacific and will see a bigger U.S. presence in the region, to include the FBI and the U.S. Coast Guard. It came at the end of a historical two-day summit at the White House and following weeks of intense negotiations between Pacific and U.S. state officials. U.S. President Joe Biden told Pacific leaders last week that the security of the United States and the world depended on security in their region.
Folks, I think this has been, we've been looking forward to this for a long time. And today, security in the Pacific and for the Pacific Islanders remains as critical as ever to us, and I hope to you as well, to secure the security of America, quite frankly, and the world depends on your security and the security of the Pacific Islands. And I really mean that. So this summit is also about deepening our enduring commitment to each other and our shared future. Our commitment to tackling the climate crisis, which threatens all of us. We're seeing the consequences of climate change around the world very vividly, including in the United States right now. And I know your nations feel it acutely. And for you all, it's an existential threat. A great deal of the history of our world is going to be written in the Indo-Pacific over the coming years and decades, and the Pacific Islands are a critical voice in shaping that future. And that's why my administration has made it a priority to strengthen our partnership with your countries and with the Pacific Islands Forum. This year, we also launched the Partners in the Blue Pacific Initiative. Kind of poetic, isn't it, the Partners in the Blue Pacific? But it's an initiative we really care about, to more effectively coordinate with our allies and partners around the world to better meet the needs of the people across the Pacific. That's why at this historic summit, we're making additional and concrete commitments. And we're launching our Pacific Partnership Strategy, the first national U.S. strategy for Pacific Islands, which is a key component to our broader Indo-Pacific strategy. We're also announcing more than $110 million in expended U.S. programs to improve the lives of Pacific Islanders, which includes more than $130 million in new investments to support climate resilience and to build sustainable blue economies in the Pacific Islands, prepare for climate impacts on public health and food security, and to strengthen sustainable development, and also to build a better early warning capacity to predict, prepare for, and respond to climate hazards. This is going to build on approximately $375 million in climate programs we currently have in the region. We're also taking several important diplomatic steps. And I'm proud to announce that following appropriate consultations, we will recognize the Cook Islands and Niue as sovereign states. And we look forward to successfully concluding negotiations for a compact of free association with three of our closest partners in the region, the Federated States of Micronesia, the Republic of the Marshall Islands, and the Republic of Palau.
You're here on Pacific Beat, here on ABC Radio Australia. And as we looked at earlier on the show, despite its early refusal, Solomon Islands was among the 14 Pacific countries to endorse a new joint partnership with the United States as part of its aim to counter China in the region. Solomon Islander Dr. Tarsisius Grabutalaka is an associate professor at the Center for Pacific Islands Studies at the University of Hawaii. He joins us now on the line from Honolulu. Dr. Grabutalaka, good morning to you.
Good morning, and thank you for having me.
As you've been studying the Pacific and its interactions in geopolitics for a very long time, we know that the United States had in its goals to counter China and its influence in the region. According to you, do you think the White House summit was a success in that competition with China?
I'm not sure it is a success in the competition with China. What I am certain about is that it is a success in terms of the U.S. projecting itself and its multilateral relationship with the Pacific Islands. And I also note that the Pacific Island countries and governments have been relatively successful in including in this declaration of partnership things that are important to the Pacific. Earlier versions did not include some of the things, but the final versions I think, you know, includes a lot of the things, including, you know, trying to ground it in the 2050 strategy for the Blue Pacific continent.
Do you think some of those changes is what brought Solomon Islands on board? We understand that they had earlier refused to sign anything, any commitments out of that summit.
I think that is the case, that changes were made and negotiations continued. I note that the Solomon Islands diplomatic note saying that they wouldn't sign was dated 25th of September. The summit didn't take place until the 28th, so they had virtually 3 days to sit down and work through some of the differences.
Why do you think, I mean, China had put forth its own, you know, similar treaty back in June. That wasn't successful. Pacific leaders shelved that plan. Why do you think the U.S. was successful this time?
Perhaps a number of reasons. One is that, you know, we know the power and influence of the U.S. In the Pacific Islands, and particularly in the North and Pacific with our COFA countries. And so that's important. But I think also important is that some of these negotiations and discussions have probably been going on for a while behind the scenes with officials talking about it. And that's quite different from China, who came to the talks and trying to push its development and security pact with Pacific Island countries without that background work. Of course, I'm not privy to a lot of the background discussions that have taken place. But I would assume that some of that have been taking place, not only when the leaders were in New York for the UN General Assembly, but perhaps even before that.
Does this put China on a back foot in the region? Would it have to change its strategy? As you mentioned, that could have been why Pacific leaders didn't support a treaty. Do you have any predictions as to how China might react?
I think China is going to come back. China is learning very quickly, as we know, on how to deal with Pacific Island countries multilaterally. A lot of China's past engagements have been bilateral. And more recently, we've seen China ramping up its multilateral engagements through things like the Foreign Affairs, Pacific Islands Foreign Ministers meeting, and more recently through the forum. It hasn't been quite successful in some cases, and the way in which China carries out its diplomacy sometimes backfires, like we saw in the last forum meeting when it had officials in places that they shouldn't be. We saw it in Nauru and Tuvalu. But at the same time, I think Beijing is learning very quickly in how to deal with Pacific Island countries multilaterally. And I don't think that Beijing herself, the idea of having a development and security agreement with the Pacific Island countries.
Oh, interesting. So you think it might come back with perhaps a new treaty?
I wouldn't be surprised if Beijing proposes a similar kind of agreement with the Pacific, either multilaterally or it could ramp up its engagements bilaterally, and through that, get some of his allies to take it to collective discussions at the forum level.
Yes, okay. So some one-upmanship that we might be seeing. I mean, what did Pacific countries walk away with from Washington? We heard earlier from U.S. President Joe Biden talking about his emphasis on security in the region. But in terms of Pacific leaders, were they able to get any concessions, anything that they wanted out of Washington?
If you look at the document, it's very broad and it covers a whole lot of things. It covers things like regionalism, climate change, and a whole list of things that are discussed. The challenge for Pacific Island countries and, of course, for Washington, D.C., is working out the details of this. And for the Washington, D.C. side, the challenge is their domestic politics and whether the Democratic Party will maintain its majorities in the U.S. Congress come midterm elections in November, and also whether they will hold on to the presidential seat after the 2024 elections. So that's the challenge on the Washington side. And on top of that, the promises that they make will have to go through a process, and any money that's been cited will have to be approved. Whereas for Beijing, a lot of these decisions are made centrally and it could quickly deploy resources. The challenge on the Pacific Island side is managing this relationship to ensure that their interests, and as expressed through the 2050 Blue Pacific Strategy, is centered. And it's what drives the relationship. So, you know, challenges on all sides, I think.
Yes, interesting. If you are just tuning in to Pacific Beat, I'm Priyanka Srinivasan. And on the show this morning, we have Dr. Tarsisius Kabutalaka, an associate professor at the Center of Pacific Island Studies at the University of Hawaii. We're talking about that historic White House summit with Pacific leaders that wrapped up just last week. We've got the outcomes, which includes $1.5 billion, I understand, that the U.S. is putting into this new Pacific strategy. Dr. Kabutalaka, do you think that's a big change, a value for money for the Pacific, perhaps?
It is. I mean, the Pacific, I think, you know, is grateful for any assistance provided by any country, whether it's the U.S. or China or any other development partners. But as I said, in the case of the U.S., a lot of this promised money is not as though there's money waiting to be used for these things. This has to go through processes in Washington, D.C., so we'll have to wait and see whether that money will become actually available for Pacific. But it's good to see that it's put out there. And let's hope that the U.S. will be able to deliver on its promises.
And that partnership, as you mentioned, was quite wide-ranging. I mean, it went from climate change to COVID-19 to these security issues. Were there any surprises in it for you?
Well, no, I'm, you know, I think, you know, one of the big things that I see there is the issue of climate change. And I'm really glad that they are much more detailed in the final draft than they were earlier on U.S. responses to climate change. However, at the same time, I am concerned in reading this. As I said earlier on, I am concerned that if we were to have a Republican majority in Congress and if the Republicans were to take over presidency in 2024, whether they will be able to or willing to commit the same kind of, you know, political will as well as resources into the kinds of things that the U.S. Is promising to do. So that's one thing that that concerns me. The other thing is, you know, the U.S. acknowledgement of nuclear impacts, of nuclear testing impacts, and particularly in relation to the Marshall Islands. So if you look at the 10th declaration, it talks about the legacies of the Cold War, and in particular, the U.S. commitment to addressing the Republic of the Marshall Islands the impacts of nuclear testing over there. That, I think, is one of the issues that has caused the Marshall Islands to stall its renegotiation of the COFR agreement with the U.S. And hopefully, the inclusion of this will open up the negotiations between the Marshall Islands and the U.S. to continue.
Another country, Kiribati, didn't participate at all in the summit. Is that significant at all? Should we be reading more into its absence?
I think it's important. We all know that Kiribati withdrew from the Pacific Islands Forum. But at the same time, I should note that the countries and territories that were involved in this summit included not only Pacific Island Forum countries, but they included New Caledonia. They have New Caledonia and French Polynesia. Well, it included not only independent countries, but territories as well. It would have been nice to have Kiribati included. Unfortunately, that's not the case. I am sure the U.S. will continue to negotiate with Kiribati bilaterally.
And just finally, Dr. Kabutalaka, ABC had an early draft of the declaration. And what really stuck out in that earlier draft was that that Pacific leaders had sort of struck out from that declaration a segment about countries discussing with each other before signing up to security treaties. I mean, it sounded like that section of that declaration was clearly aimed at the Solomon Islands and its treaty with China. What do you think about Pacific leaders striking that out? Is it realistic for Pacific countries to discuss security arrangements with each other ahead of time?
Well, I suppose, the Pacific Islands Forum has always had as part of its principle the respect for each member's sovereign rights. And I suppose that came up in the discussions. Like I said, I'm not privy to a lot of this discussion, but I would assume that there were expressions of concern that whatever agreements that they come up with collectively, while expressing those collective interests, at the same time respects the sovereign rights of each country.
Very interesting stuff. Thank you so much for your time this morning, Dr. Kabutalaka.
Thank you for having me.
That was Dr. Tarsisius Kabutalaka, Associate Professor at the Center of Pacific Island Study at the University of Hawaii. Pacific Beat. Around the world, some Commonwealth countries are preparing to update their currency to feature the new British monarch, King Charles III. That includes Solomon Islands, where early discussions are underway at the central bank to swap Queen Elizabeth out for the new monarch, as Hugo Hodge reports.
Since the Solomon Islands dollar was first introduced in 1977, its coins have always featured an effigy of Queen Elizabeth II. Now, Solomon Island coins are set for a facelift. Early conversations are underway at the central bank to introduce the country's new head of state, King Charles III, on the country's coins. The central bank's manager for corporate communications, Ural Matanani, said updating the country's coins was discussed in a recent board meeting.
So what was discussed on the board level, as far as the information I have received, is that the governor informed them that it is a normal process now that we'll have to change from the Queen's effigy to the King. And established protocols are also there in place for this process to take place.
At the moment, there's no timeline on when King Charles will start appearing on Solomon Islands currency.
The timing now hasn't been confirmed. It will take time to have that changes take place, yeah.
First, the Royal Mint in the United Kingdom will need to design an effigy of King Charles, which needs to be endorsed by Buckingham Palace. It's expected the bust of King Charles will face left instead of right like the Queen does. The Royal Mint has yet to release a date for when the new coins will enter circulation. In Australia, that process will start next year, while in New Zealand, it will take several years because of a backlog of coins. Introducing new coins and banknotes can be expensive for Pacific nations as they have to get their currency minted overseas in countries like the UK, Canada, and Australia. The Central Bank of Solomon Islands mints their coins at the Royal Australian Mint, but it wouldn't say how much it will be spending on the new coins.
In terms of costings, I will not have the information with me now, but in any case, especially with changes relating to The currency in the different denominations, there definitely will be costs associated with this kind of process. So when that issue starts to pick up, and especially moving towards changing the effigy, there'll definitely be more discussions into this.
Jim Noble, the managing director of Noble Numismatics, says upgrading their coins is something Commonwealth countries are already familiar with.
You know, sometimes over the reign of Queen Elizabeth, we had several design changes because of her ageing. So simply, every 25 years, you get a change in design anyway.
He says the old coins can be recycled.
They can withdraw them if they wish and reprocess them by reprocessing the metal.
But for the time being, coins featuring Queen Elizabeth are legal tender in Solomon Islands, at least until the bank sets a date to demonetise them. As for the rare coin collectors, Mr. Noble doesn't expect a rush for coins featuring the Queen's face.
Those that are circulating, they'd be a big enough issue to satisfy demand. I mean, if every coin collector in the world wanted one, it would make a difference to the market value.
That was coin expert Jim Noble ending that report from Hugo Hodge. Now it's time to find out what's making news this Monday morning around the Pacific. And to do that, I'm joined by reporter Kyle Evans. Good morning, Kyle.
Good morning, Priyanka.
We're with you, well, you might not know it, but an hour later than we usually are because here in Australia we've moved our clocks forward because of daylight savings. But yes, a lot of people around the Pacific, I guess, won't notice. We are, though, with a little extra sleeping. And you've got some very exciting news for us. Well, first one, this is a bit of an interesting one. English Rugby League's CEO has been put in hot water following comments around Fiji. What did they say?
Yeah, hot water indeed. So England's rugby football boss is being called to step down following some pretty disparaging comments he made about the Fiji national team a couple of days ago. So the CEO, this is basically the guy in charge of rugby league football in England. So he was discussing preparations for the World Cup, and Fiji are actually set to play the UK in the first round matchup there. But unfortunately, it's some sort of gala dinner. He's got on stage and joked that nobody from the Fiji team had been arrested yet, hence preparations were going well. Now, this man in particular, he was already set to depart his role as CEO at the end of the year, but there's now been calls for him to step down immediately following the comments, which has obviously offended some people given the disparaging nature of them.
And with those calls to step down, has the CEO come out to say anything?
Yeah, absolutely. So he has apologised unreservedly, according to reports by The Guardian. He's denied that his words had any racist connotations, and the competition has also confirmed it's received a complaint and it's following a due process before a potential investigation into its own CEO. So, yeah, definitely not a great look before the country hosts the biggest rugby league event in the world, basically.
Yes, and we'll see if Fiji Rugby comes out to say something about this because, they are very pointed remarks. And now let's head to Vanuatu, which is going to implement a new policy to address labour shortages. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. So the government has started developing a national employment policy to address a potential drain of skilled labour after an expansion to New Zealand's seasonal worker scheme. So New Zealand's scheme will recruit an extra 3,000 seasonal workers to address some shortages it's got in the horticulture sector. It's been welcomed by the Vanuatu government, but there's concerns it could really exacerbate a labour crisis it's already facing domestically. So essentially, this policy will try and find a solution for both countries.
Yeah, very interesting because I know Samoa had also come up a couple of weeks ago and said they were putting caps and limits on the number of labourers that they were going to send abroad to New Zealand and Australia for work there. So interesting to see Vanuatu doing something similar. I mean, do we know any details? Do we know how this policy might work?
Yeah, I mean, that's the million-dollar question. It wasn't completely specific. It just said that it will implement new guidelines across Vanuatu's employment sectors. So it'll be interesting to see what that means. I mean, if I had to speculate, that could mean things like fixed-term contracts or maybe an upskilling of workers, you know, onshore within those jobs. They think it's going to be the tourism sector that's hit hardest immediately. But yeah, it'll be interesting to see how it plays out because, yeah, like you said, it has been a bit of an ongoing issue, but there's also major benefits to these labour programs as well.
Yeah, and I'd encourage people to head on to the ABC website. I think about a month ago, our reporter Dubravka Volodar sort of took a deep dive into the impacts of seasonal work on the tourism sector around the Pacific and had some interesting case studies there about from, you know, tourism workers, hospitality, business owners who said, yeah, they're really struggling with their workers all going overseas. So interesting to see countries now, you know, changing policy. Vanuatu also has the election coming up just next week, I think, 10 days away, a snap election. So we'll see if there is a change in government, whether this policy will be continued there. Thank you, Kyle, for those stories from around the region.
Thank you, Priyanka.
That was Kyle Evans bringing us our daily dose of news wrap, all the news that's making headlines around the Pacific. But don't go anywhere. We've still got some news for you here on Pacific Beat. Coming up, we'll hear about an ambitious project to get the Guam kingfisher back into the wild after 30 years only in captivity. These amazing birds, these Guam kingfishers, are endangered because of an introduced species. It's called the brown tree snake, and they just gobble them up.
The brown tree snake, when it arrived, had a big party and a big snack festival, and all the birds unfortunately face their demise.
Very soon we'll find out how biologists plan to undo that deadly snack festival, that snake snack festival, I guess. And also on the show, in about 10-15 minutes or so, I'll be talking to a man who has named a newly discovered fly in Papua New Guinea after Bitcoin. In fact, it's called Bitcoin. Why is that? Well, stick around to find out. And coming up after this very short break, we'll look into a new project aimed at to track visitors to Palau and reward them for touring sustainably.
Tune in to SBS Samoan News on ABC Radio Australia. SBS Samoan News features independent news and stories connecting you to life in Australia and Samoan-speaking Australians by our friends at SBS Australia. SBS Samoan News. Tune in Mondays and Thursdays at 6:05 a.m. Samoan time for 1 hour of news in Samoan language on ABC Radio Australia.
You are listening to ABC Radio Australia. I'm Priyanka Srinivasan with you this Monday morning for Pacific Beat. Tourists coming to Palau will soon be rewarded for participating in sustainable activities thanks to a soon-to-be-launched app that tracks tourists' impact on the island. The Allow Palau app then gives those who take part in a sustainable tourism access to exclusive activities, as Rovka Volodar reports.
The idea for Olau Palau was born out of a desire to reward tourists who limit their carbon footprint.
Olau is an action where you're calling someone over. So you're asking somebody who you know well in an informal way to come join you or to be a part of something that you're doing.
Jennifer Gibbons is a co-founder of the NGO The Palau Legacy Project and a co-developer of the Olau Palau Initiative.
We thought, okay, how can we give visitors who come to Palau that experience of a family member, that experience of a good friend, instead of just here's a quick trip, we drop into Palau.
The idea behind Olau Palau is pretty simple. Travelers doing their bit to cut down on pollution will be rewarded by unlocking cultural experiences that are normally reserved for friends and family.
The idea under development is that you will be able to do so with an app that starts to record all of your amazing activity in Palau. And then it'll start to unlock and reveal the different experiences that you could access because of that.
Activities that earn points will include taking part in ecotourism projects, eating sustainable seafood, and answering questions about Palau's biodiversity and culture. Pre-COVID, Palau relied heavily on tourism. After stopping flights in and out of the country at the start of the pandemic, visitors have slowly started trickling in this year. To support businesses get back on their feet, the NGO-driven project is aiming to help the country to rebuild its tourism sector in a sustainable way. And this isn't the first initiative Palau has launched to encourage tourists to treat its environment with care. It includes the Palau Pledge, which requires foreigners to sign an environmental promise when they enter.
Touching, feeding, chasing, or taking away our wild animals is bad for our island.
In this Palau Pledge video that is shown on flights, tourists are urged to limit their footprints.
If you break it, it takes years to grow again.
But this newest initiative is dialing it up a notch.
Every time you do those things that help Palau survive as an island nation in that positive way, we should be offering you up points that allow you to access and unlock experiences that visitor who would just come for the weekend and leave potentially would not necessarily have.
The rewards can then be tailored to a traveler's interest, be that swimming, diving, hiking, or cultural activities. They aren't free, but only available to tourists who have earned a certain number of points in the app. Once tourists reach a certain number of points, they get access to certain experiences, like visiting the remote Bunkelkelau village. Rose Ongalibang is from that village.
The village is a very old village. It has its old stone path. You go through the mangrove channel to the village, and it's old stone path. You cannot have roads like cars and everything, so you just go. So that's what we want to, you know, introduce to the world, that there is such a village in Palau.
She says sustainability is at the heart of everything they plan to do.
The visitors can come and visit. They take a boat from the jungle river where you can feed the crocodile, and after that you come into the channel to the village. When you come to the village, you can experience taro farming. When I say taro, it's the giant taro and the purple taro. And then you can go to this historical site.
Other experiences are said to include visiting a freshwater lake or taking a tour to dive in a secluded spot. Tourists that don't gain enough points won't have access to these experiences. Palau Tourism's Ray Marino says they're still waiting for tourist numbers to increase.
Reliant on the flights that come in, so far we only have about 2 or 3 flights a week. So it's coming in mostly from Guam, maybe about 1/3 of what we used to have.
But he says the personal carbon app is a good initiative for when numbers pick up.
It's a good thing to have. We want our tourists, when they come to Palau, to be conscious of the impact that they have. And I think that's a good way of mitigating that.
Jennifer Gibbons hopes the app will be launched by the end of the year.
That was Dubrovka Volodar with that report.
You're listening to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
Now to Guam, where plans are underway to bring its national kingfisher back into the wild. The bird was forced into extinction 30 years ago after the brown tree snake destroyed populations. As biologist Anthony Torriito from Guam's Department of Agriculture explains, a bold new experiment will see 9 of the birds released into the wild, not in Guam though, but on an island near Kiribati.
So on Guam, it's called, in the Chamorro language, we call it the seahick, or how it's known around the world as the Guam kingfisher. And the seahick is endemic to the island of Guam, meaning that that genetic line is only found here on Guam. And it's a very culturally important species to this land. The indigenous culture, the Chamorro culture, has legends surrounding it. But also ecologically, it's truly an important bird because it's one of the birds that's primarily carnivorous. And a lot of the other birds are insectivorous or omnivorous. So these birds, when in their natural environment, they usually eat geckos, skinks, little worms. They can even eat like mice, baby mice. And sometimes too, they can also predate on other birds. So they kind of play an important role in the food chain.
You mentioned that they haven't existed in the wild for 30 years. They've only existed in captivity. How did they become extinct in the first place?
So post-World War II, the brown tree snake was introduced to Guam accidentally. And over the years, the brown tree snake has definitely multiplied in numbers. And to this day, there's an estimated 2 million snakes on the island. So the birds, because they had essentially no natural predators here on Guam, the brown tree snake, when it arrived, had a big party and a big snack festival. And all the birds, unfortunately, face their demise. 10 out of 12 forest birds, and the sihik, or the Guam kingfisher, being one of them.
Did the kingfisher becoming extinct on Guam have a bit of a negative impact on the ecosystem, given that it was obviously a natural predator, which was taken out by a foreign predator?
You know, that's a very interesting question, because as a biologist, I always think about the ecosystem. And it's interesting because growing up on Guam, I didn't know what a Guam kingfisher or a Guam rail were, the two of our key, I guess, star species, right? I didn't know anything about those birds. And it's only until I studied and became a biologist where I really actually see that the impacts have affected the ecosystem. So when you come to Guam, you do see a lot of geckos, skinks. It's very full of insects, as you would say. The brown tree snake does eat some of the native geckos and skinks, but the birds definitely also played a role into, I guess, keeping those populations of the geckos and skinks under control.
Now, I know you won't be re-releasing the bird back to Guam straight away. The trial will initially see you guys release the bird on a group of islands called Palmyra Atoll. Can you talk a little bit about that and exactly how many birds you'll be releasing initially?
Palmyra was chosen because it has a similar environment to what they had on Guam. And I believe there will be 9 birds slated for Palmyra to act as the initial population to study.
And what kind of challenges are these birds likely to encounter? I mean, they haven't been obviously in the wild for 30 years. Will their instincts remain intact and things like that?
You know, that's also another interesting question. And I think that's exactly why this experiment is happening. In the wild, it will be the first time in how many years, 30 years, that they'll be able to, I guess, reinvigorate their rewild their instincts as to raising a chick, but also to foraging on their own, since the species have been in captivity, like mentioned, for more than 30 years.
Now, I know this project is only in its proposal stage at the moment, but from what I understand, it is definitely going ahead. So I guess what's the next step from here, and when are we likely to see these birds get released?
So I believe, you know, we are in the proposal stage, yes, but our releases are anticipated to start happening as early as summer of next year. And that could be pushed back or that can be pushed forward. But I believe the releases were supposed to happen earlier, but with the global pandemic, that definitely pushed a lot of projects back. But nonetheless, we're charting course to being on time with this project. And we hope that the world is ready for the return of the sihik.
And I understand if all goes to plan, there is eventually down the track a plan to try and get them back on their native island of Guam as well.
Yes, our goal is to protect and benefit the native species of Guam for the people of Guam. By doing this, we will not only return the bird back to the wild, and hopefully it will benefit the ecology, but more importantly, it will benefit the people here culturally. Like I said, when I was growing up, I didn't know of this bird. And then now that I know of it, it's like, wow, it's pretty interesting that this bird is only found on Guam. So it's something to hold close to us. And hopefully by then, the snake technology will improve a little more. Each day, it's always about the improvement of the snake suppression technology. And we can hopefully find a place secure enough to have brown tree snakes controlled, and it will also help benefit this bird's release and return back onto Guam.
And last question before we go, just in your professional opinion, as a wildlife biologist, how do you think the birds will go? Do you think they'll thrive?
You know, it's so interesting that, you know, sometimes I don't give these animals enough credit, but we kind of had an accidental release back in 2018, and that bird actually was on Guam, and he was a 7-year-old bird, and he survived practically in the wild on his own for 6 months. Considering he was 7 years old and survived 6 months, I have no doubt that these birds will return strong. And the resilience of these birds is quite amazing. And the fact that they're still here today is definitely a story worth worth keeping and telling and passing on until they do return to the wild, and then we can have more stories to tell.
That was Guam wildlife biologist Anthony Otori-Ito speaking there to reporter Kyle Evans. You're listening to Pacific Beat here on ABC Radio Australia. In Western Australia, there are fears some fish populations could disappear forever, and it's prompted a controversial proposal to ban some recreational fishing. While debate on the plan continues, an army of volunteers is trying to tackle the problem themselves by embarking on Australia's largest seagrass restoration project, Kaysen Ho reports.
From the surface, seagrass might look like a watery meadow. But underwater, it's an unsung hero.
If you look at a stage, you see the actors and everybody focuses in on the actors, but the stage actually sets the scene. Well, the backdrop, that stage in the background, is what the seagrasses and the seaweeds are. They are very important. They're the major primary producer in the system, and they capture carbon and turn it into oxygen.
That's Professor Gary Kendrick. He's a marine biologist at the University of Western Australia. He says seagrass plays another crucial role.
A lot of juvenile fish settle into seagrasses first, and they live in the seagrass meadows because there's a lot of food in them until they get bigger and they move onto the reef. That's just a simple example of the values of seagrasses. Their habitat, and they're also a great place to go snorkeling and diving.
The meadows are a unique biodiversity hotspot, home to species such as pink snapper and others which feed on the bottom of the ocean, all of which are in declining numbers. It's such a concern, the WA government has suggested banning recreational fishing of some species for up to 9 months of the year. In Coburn Sound near Perth, hundreds of divers and other volunteers are on a mission to restore thousands of hectares of seagrass that have been lost to industrial development.
That's one, that's two, that's what you'll be counting. But you can actually see on this one some teeny tiny fruit starting to fall. So we're just counting the stalks for now. We'll count the fruit in a separate exercise.
The divers bring the seagrass fruit onshore for processing. They then hope to release 1 million seeds back into the ocean at strategic locations. Researcher Rachel Austin explains.
Seagrasses do experience type 3 survivorship curves, which mean, unfortunately, a lot of the seeds produced don't actually grow into adult plants, which means we need to collect a large number of seeds in order to get a couple of the plants growing. And it's with this community involvement allowing us to collect the hopefully millions of seeds each year that will actually start to have a good impact on the seagrass meadows of Coburn Sound.
Seagrass restoration has been running here for nearly 20 years, and it wouldn't be possible without volunteers like Tanya Douthwaite and Sonia Wallisheim.
We've got shore roles, so you don't need to be a diver to be involved. You could help out with lookout, you could help out with collecting wrack from the beach in part of our other project, and then, of course, in water.
It's a real value of mine as well to do community and sustainability, and it really hit a number of things for me because it really restores the habitat that I like to spend time in.
And with a helping hand, it's hoped the habitat may be around for generations to come.
That was Kaysen Ho with that report. Thank you for joining me this Monday morning. You're tuned in to Pacific Beat. Imagine setting up a hotel in your garden for frogs. That's what residents in rural Australia, in a rural Australian town, are being encouraged to do after the region was hit by devastating bushfires. The blaze destroyed habitat and put frog species in danger. But now frogs in East Gippsland in the state of Victoria are getting new accommodation. Reporter Natasha Skapova spoke with the East Gippsland Catchment Management Authority's Bryce Watts Parker about the project.
The frog hotels create a habitat that allow frogs to take refuge throughout the day. So it provides a moist microclimate, so when it's hot, frogs have somewhere nice and cool and safe to be in.
The devastating bushfires of 2019 and 2020 forced native frogs from their natural habitats closer to the towns of East Gippsland. Bryce is pushing for locals to build frog hotels in their backyards to mimic a wetland habitat that are often lacking in built-up areas.
What we've been seeing now is quite a lot of frogs in people's backyards because that's where there's the unburnt vegetation, there's lots of food, and people make that habitat for them.
Far East Gippsland boasts a unique variety of frogs that travel there from New South Wales and other parts of Victoria. The hotels are aimed at frogs with greater climbing capabilities, including the green and golden bell frog, brown tree frog, Perrin's tree frog, southern bell frog, whistling tree frog and the screaming tree frog.
Frogs are attracted to the hotel because normally they're well vegetated with native endemic plants or other moisture-retaining plants. It also provides protection from predators that might be out and about, like kookaburras and potentially household pets as well.
East Gippsland CMA head Beck Hemming says the project aims to increase community awareness about the role of frogs in the environment.
It was a way of getting community involved and showing the community that frogs are really important for our waterways.
Frogs are used as biological indicators to assess the quality of waterways, pollution levels and vegetation health.
Frogs are generally considered a bit of a canary in the coal mine, that if something is starting to go wrong, you'll notice that the frog populations disappear.
Although the bushfires ravaged frog habitats, populations have recovered due to high rainfall in the region that has led to a boom in insect numbers, which is good news for frogs.
Frog populations have been recovering really well after the fires. Their numbers have been exploding. This can be due to the fact that we've had a lot more water and also a lot more food available to them.
East Gippsland CMA is also encouraging locals to monitor frogs and other wildlife using the iNaturalist app. It allows users to photograph animals and upload them to the server where they can be identified and the data used for research.
We're hoping to also use iNaturalist and encourage people to engage with citizen science with a variety of other species like birds and turtles and stuff like that, all species that are really important to our waterways.
East Gippsland Catchment Management Authority's Bryce Watts Parker was the one speaking there to reporter Natasha Skapova. And that just about brings us to the end of Pacific Beat. I wasn't keen to see you guys go and a little muck up there, but thank you for tuning in this Monday morning. If you do want any more stories from the Pacific, do tune in or to here on ABC Radio Australia, or you can find us online on abc.net.au/Pacific. Till then, have a lovely day.